Today's Taisho will be on Case 1 in the Pi Yen Lu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 1 is entitled Emperor Wu Asks Bodhidharma. Engo's introduction. Smoke over the hill indicates fire. Horns over the fence indicate an ox. Given one corner, you grasp the other three. One glance, you discern the smallest difference. Such quickness, however, is only too common among robed monks. When you have stopped the delusive activity of consciousness, then, whatever situation you may find yourself in, you enjoy perfect freedom in adversity and prosperity, in taking and in giving. Now tell me, how in fact will this sort of person behave? See the following. Main subject. Emperor Wu of Liang asked Bodhidharma, what is the main principle of the holy teachings? Bodhidharma said, emptiness, no holiness. Who is standing before me? Asked the emperor. I don't know, Bodhidharma said. The emperor did not grasp his meaning. Thereupon, Bodhidharma crossed the river and went to the land of Wei. The emperor later spoke of this to Shiko, another monk, who said, do you in fact know who this person is? The emperor said, he said he didn't know. Shiko said, this is the Bodhisattva Guanyin, the bearer of the Buddha's heart seal. The emperor was full of regret and wanted to send for Bodhidharma, but Shiko said, it's no good sending a messenger to fetch him back now. Even if all the people went, he would not return. Secho's verse, holy teaching, emptiness. What is the secret? Again, who stands before me? I don't know. Inevitable, the thorns and briars spring up secretly. By night he crossed the river. All the people could not bring him back. Now, so many years gone by, still Bodhidharma fills your mind in vain. Stop thinking of him. A gentle breeze pervades the universe. The master looked around. Is the patriarch there? Yes, bring him to me, and he can wash my feet. I want to thank you so much for coming to practice Zen this morning. Sometimes life is more strange than we could even imagine. I'm sure you have been following the events of the last day. Yesterday was an incredibly busy day for me. In my job, I meet with teachers in my program individually for an hour apiece. So at the end of the semester, I meet with about 34 teachers, and that's 34 hours in the space of about a week. So I get there around 9 o'clock or a little before, and then I have a meeting, and then I have another meeting and another meeting. And I get to go to lunch, and then I have to come back and I do more meetings, and you really have to be focused. But I went to get some lunch, and as I was going into the student center, I could see on the TV, just in the corner of my consciousness, you know, I was so focused on everything that was going on. I was so focused on my work, my meetings with my teachers, problems with students. This was at the center of my consciousness. And I went into the student center, and I was walking by the main desk. And you may know that there's a TV in the foyer of the student center. And as I was walking by, just sort of out of the corner of my mind, I could hear something about shootings, you know. And I didn't really pay attention. I went downstairs and I got some lunch. And then it hit me. What was that about shootings? You know, did I hear that right? Was this a news show about something that happened years ago, a Columbine? Was that maybe a program on television, you know? So as I was coming back out, I looked up at the screen, and then they were broadcasting the news about the shootings. And I had to go back to work. All of this happened yesterday. And the day before yesterday, in the evening, I was surfing on the internet, it was Thursday night, and I had been grading papers feverishly, and I now grade all my papers online to try to save paper. I needed to take a break, and so I was surfing the internet, and I was actually surfing Bodhidharma. I did a Google search for Bodhidharma, and this YouTube video came up, and it was all about how they're refurbishing Bodhidharma's monument in China. And it basically, the film explains that Bodhidharma's stupa, basically, was sort of lost track of, but that archaeologists found it again. They know where it is, and they took us. The video takes you to the stupa, and it apparently some Japanese archaeologists found it again, and a group of Japanese people have a Bodhidharma association, and they wanted to refurbish this site, and they had gotten some money to build some buildings. And and in the film, if you go to see it, it's on our Facebook page. You know, the area is very desolate. It's treeless and looks very much like a wasteland. But they say that originally, according to historical records, at one time this was a beautiful forest. So now they're going to replant trees there, and they're building a temple again, and people come. It showed large numbers of people come every year to honor Bodhidharma. And in my mind, you know, these two things fit together. These two things somehow fit together. They happened within 24 hours of each other. You know, I went to bed Thursday night thinking about the Bodhidharma stupa and about this person, Bodhidharma, who came to China from India. And he's quite important to our tradition. You know, he taught the kind of meditation we practice. And he was a real historical figure. He really did come to China. There are records that he really did meet Emperor Wu of Liang. And that he really didn't hit it off with the emperor, and so on. All of that apparently has some basis in real history. So, on the one hand, you know, a Thursday night, I went to bed thinking about Bodhidharma and about Zen and his particular approach to Zen practice. And then the next day I got up and I went to work, and then there's this shooting. And, these two things happened side by side. And there, Friday night I went to bed thinking about the shootings and all the people who have been suffering, all of these kids getting killed. Buddhism teaches that people are fundamentally good. actually. That Buddhism teaches that people are fundamentally enlightened, fundamentally awake, fundamentally compassionate. The Buddhist teaching is that the core of your consciousness is this radiant, compassionate intelligence that automatically reaches out to others with loving kindness and wants to protect and help them. That's a Buddhist teaching, basic Buddhist teaching. When something like this happens at Columbine, you know, it seems so. Something like happened at Columbine or happened in Connecticut yesterday. It seems so shocking, and it seems to contradict so much of what we believe. You know, Buddhist teaching is that people are fundamentally good, and yet in Connecticut yesterday, somebody went in and killed more than 20 people. These two things are side by side in our world, really, not just in my own experience, but in the world, right? These two things are side by side. You know, humans have this tremendous potential for cultivation and compassion. And when you meet people who are genuinely accomplished human beings, it makes, you know, it makes you just want to melt with gratitude and happiness, really. You know, I have met people in my life who are really deeply compassionate people. And, you know, I have also read writings by people that I don't know, but when I read their writings, I just feel that these people are really deeply accomplished human beings. You know, sometimes I will read something. Sometimes it will be a Buddhist text, but sometimes it will be by somebody in the modern world. I'll read something and I'll just think, you know, I'm so glad that this person is in the world, or this person was in the world. Because, you know, they hold up a mirror in which we can see our best selves, you know, reflected. I had the chance many, many years ago to actually meet the Dalai Lama. You know, he came to our Zen Center in Seattle. Since then, I have read many things the Dalai Lama has written, and I'm quite convinced that he has managed to embody compassion in this very, very profound way. You know, so many people talk about what it was like, what it's like to be in his presence, and how liberated they feel by his kindness. You know. And of course, apparently from the historical records, this was also the case with the Buddha, that people who met him felt this tremendous, it was like a tremendous weight taken off their shoulders in the presence of his loving kindness. They just felt this tremendous, it was like being lifted up, you know. Many people commented on this aspect of the Buddha's personality. Like the Dalai Lama, he embodied this compassion, and just encountering it is so liberating and refreshing and renewing, you know. So, you know, on the one hand, we have this potential. All of us have this potential to be like that, you know. The Buddhist teaching is basically about appealing to what is best in people. You know, Buddhist teaching, the Buddhist approach is to say, look, you can be like this. You know, you can be like this. Just work on yourself. So, you know, fundamentally, in teaching, you know, in the world of education and teaching, there's a word called pedagogy. It's not a very appealing word, but it means your teaching strategy, or your teaching philosophy, or your teaching technique. And you could say Buddhist pedagogy is to speak to the best part of yourself, and say, you can be Buddha yourself. You can be a Bodhisattva yourself. So, you know, the Buddhist approach is not to say you're a bad person. You know, that's not Buddhist pedagogy. You know, Buddhist pedagogy doesn't say you're a really bad person and if you don't watch out, you're going to do really bad things. You know, so keep an eye on yourself at all times. The Buddhist approach is to say, fundamentally, you're a really good person and you don't always manage to be at your best, but you can do it, you know. Let's do it together, you know. So that's Buddhist pedagogy. And it's a really inspiring. You know, I have met people in my life who have inspired me to be a better person, to try to be a better person. You know, when we sit down on the cushion, we're really trying to get in touch with that Buddha nature, that radiant compassion in ourselves. I think we've all felt it. You know, sometimes you sit down on the cushion and your spirit can really be crushed, you know, by events. And you encounter, you know, and you can be angry, you can be fearful. You know, sometimes we all get to this place where, you know, we feel very embattled or very, you know, like we're cornered. And when we're in that state, we're not very generous and kind. You know, we're either licking our wounds or we're very defensive. But, you know, when you sit down on the cushion and you begin to open up a little bit, you know, this natural kindness, this natural generosity comes out. You know, and sometimes you get off the cushion and you just feel like giving everybody a hug. And this isn't contrived, you know, this is really natural. People naturally want to give other people a hug, you know, I really believe that. I feel that myself when I do a couple hours of Zazen. You know, on the other hand, you know, all of this is true, but on the other hand, you know, people, I have said this before, and I think it's really important to appreciate. You know, on the other hand, you know, people wildly underestimate human potential for destructiveness, you know. We wildly underestimate, I think, our potential for destructiveness. You know, the 20th century, I'm sure you know this, but they said the 20th century was the most in terms of loss of human life, the 20th century was the most destructive century ever. You know, tens of millions of people died in the 20th century through war and systematic violence. And I'm sure you know, when you were growing up, you probably saw films of Allied troops marching into Germany and encountering people who had been in prison camps, you know, the extermination camps. You know, I think all of these events, you know, should have affected us more than they have, really, you know. I always sort of marvel at the fact that we don't have a realistic understanding of ourselves. You know, when I was a little boy, one of my best friends in Seattle, when I was a teenager, I should say, one of my best friends in Seattle, I lived in Seattle for a while, and then we moved away, and then we came back because my father was in the Navy. But, you know, one of my friends was a guy named Larry Stone, who's now a famous sommelier. He went to UW to get his PhD in comparative literature, and he has gone on to become like a famous, world-famous wine expert. But anyway, I had a summer job working for Larry's parents. They had left, you know, Germany, Nazi Germany. They were in the import business, and they were moving all their stuff from one warehouse to another. And they gave me a great summer job, just loading up their truck. I had a wonderful time. I made some money, and And I remember Mrs. Stone made me lunch, and I was in the kitchen with her, and she made me a sandwich. And when I looked, I could see on her arm the tattooed number on her arm, you know. So, you know, there's this other side of human beings, you know. On the one side, you know, on one hand, our fundamentally loving kindness. But I think we underestimate our capacity to get confused and to become destructive, even though, you know, we've had a century of great destructiveness, you know. I think we have to be honest about our potential for destructiveness without falling into self-hatred, you know, because I don't think self-hatred is justified or constructive. But on the other hand, we have a potential to be really bad, you know, to do really bad things. And we all have it, you know. I was reading about a few months ago a book on Hitler. And the it was a review, a book review of a book on Hitler. And it ended by saying something like this: Adolf Hitler continues to be a mystery. And I thought, that is so false, right? He's not a mystery. You know, what he did is very easily understood. If you just acknowledge that we have a potential to be very destructive, hateful, and fearful. You know, in other words, I don't think Hitler's a mystery at all. I think all of us have a kind of Hitler potential. You know, all of us have a Hitler potential. We have this capability of being very fearful, very destructive, very hateful. And it's in all of us. And we can say abstractly, well, yes, I know that. But it's, I mean, one of the reasons I do Zazen is because I love to get in touch with that Buddha mind, that compassionate, loving mind. On the other hand, one of the reasons I do Zazen is so that I don't become Hitler. And I have my Hitler aspect, you know. I don't know about you, but I definitely have a Hitler aspect, you know. Sometimes I can get really mad, you know, I can get really mad. And I don't allow myself to get angry very often, but I know that there's a part of me that can get really mad, you know. Every once in a while, somebody will light my fuse, you know, and it's I just, you know, do 0 to 60, and I, you know, when I see that part of myself, I realize, you know, I have to be careful, you know. But a lot of us don't always allow ourselves to realize that we have this potential. You know, we have this potential. So, you know, people don't have to do Zazen. You don't have to do Zazen. But I think all of us have to be aware that we have this great potential to be extraordinarily loving, kind people. But we all have this Hitler aspect to ourselves, you know. And that what happened in Connecticut isn't inhuman or unusual. You know, last night when I was going to bed and I was thinking about somebody walking into a school and shooting 27 people, I remembered something I read when I was an undergraduate. I don't know if you've ever read The Odyssey. But The Odyssey is a great classic of Western literature. It's about the wanderings of a tribal leader, a Greek tribal leader named Odysseus. He's dragged into the Trojan War. He doesn't really want to go to war, but he's dragged into the Trojan War. And the Greeks go to war with the Trojans. And you might know the story, you know, they can't defeat Troy for a long time, and then they make a big wooden horse, and they hide in the wooden horse, and the Trojans bring the horse into the city, and the Greeks come out of the horse, and they kill everybody. Well, the Odyssey doesn't deal with all of these events, but it deals with some of the military campaign against Troy. I'm sorry, the Iliad deals with those events. The Odyssey deals with Odysseus's attempt to get home from the war in Troy, after Troy is destroyed. He's trying to get home, and he can't get home. He keeps getting knocked off course. But at the end of his journey, when he finally gets home, it turns out that his wife, Penelope, everybody's thought that Odysseus is dead in the war, and since he hasn't come home for years and years. And all of these suitors are trying to marry Penelope because she's wealthy, and they want to inherit her property, basically Odysseus's kingdom. And she is constantly putting him off and saying, well, but Odysseus still might come home, he still might come home. The point is that when Odysseus comes home, the suitors, all these people who are trying to win Penelope's hand, are all hanging around his villa, basically. And when Odysseus comes home, he walks into the villa, he conspires to have all the doors sealed, and then he takes his arrows out and he kills every one of them. Like, you know, he kills them all. This is so similar to what happened in Connecticut yesterday. You know, one of our culture heroes slays all of his rivals, all of these people, because he thinks he has a right to do so. You know, and he's a hero. At the end, this is understood to be just action. So, you know, we have this tendency, we have this tradition of violence, just violence, you know, righteous anger, and so on and so on. And it's right there. It's part of ourselves. You know, I don't think that really Hitler is a mystery. I think he's got a human face. And when we say he's a mystery, what we're really saying is we don't want to look at our own potential for destructiveness. I think you don't have to do zazen, but people have to be aware of this potential, and they have to work on themselves somehow. You know, we all have to do work on ourselves. We all have to understand that we have this potential to be extraordinarily compassionate and kind, or very fearful, very deluded and destructive, and it takes work. You don't have to get up on Saturday and do zazen, but it's a naive view, I think, of the human being to imagine that we can be good without effort. You know, every day I encounter in myself something that needs to be worked on, and I'm just being honest. You know. Every day, I do something that is, you know, not quite loving kindness embodied, you know. And when I do my zazen, I'm polishing, you know. I'm cleaning myself up, you know. And at the end of the day, if I sit down on the cushion, you know, I realize I shouldn't have done that, you know. I should have done something else. Next time, I'll try harder. You know, you know, things can tick you off, you know, can make you angry. And it's okay to be angry. At the end of the day, you sit down on the cushion and you assess. You think, well, you know, maybe I didn't handle that right, you know. I'll try to be a better person tomorrow. And I think all people need to sort of do something like that. You need to do something. You have to actually be committed, I think, to being a good person. It has to be like a commitment or a goal. And I think you have to take it seriously as an objective, life objective. And it takes work every day, you know, to be a good person. We Zen people practice zazen. You know, we sit down on the cushion, and this is how we purify body, mind, and heart. And our method is to clear away obstacles by returning to the formless realm. And in that realm, you know, we become really fearless, you know, fearless. And when fear disappears, compassion arises. You know, this is our method, this is our pedagogy. I think we need, as a society, to realize that the whole society needs to be dedicated to producing people who are kind and compassionate. And that unless we make like very serious effort, we aren't going to get people who are kind and compassionate. You know. So I think even though it may seem sometimes that Zazen doesn't change the world, it's not really solving the problems of the world. I think it's very, very important, you know. This is our way of being better people. You know, you sit down on the cushion and you work through your fears and your obstacles, your anger and your sense of envy or regret. And you get off the cushion and, you know, you're probably a little kinder, a little more patient, a little more loving. And, and you don't go out and shoot somebody today. You know, and this is like an achievement for human beings. You know, we have to constantly work on not being that person. You know, I would say, even though we're fundamentally good, we can get very confused. You know, the Bodhidharma really existed. And he wrote a number of things that have actually survived, that we have, and I just wanted to read you one thing. This is something Bodhidharma wrote, or apparently something Bodhidharma wrote. We can't really know absolutely. He said, "I have always admired the wise ones. I have broadly cultivated all the practices. I have always esteemed the pure lands of the Buddhas and looked up to the teachings that have come down to us as a thirsty man longs for water. Those who have been able to meet the Buddha and realize great awakening are in the millions, and those who have obtained the four fruits are numberless. I thought that the heavenly mansions were really another country and the hells another place, and that if one were to attain the path and get the fruits, one's bodily form would actually change. I unrolled sutra scrolls to seek blessings. Through pure practice, I tried to produce karmic causes. In confusion, I went around in circles, chasing my mind and creating karma. Thus I passed many years without the leisure to take a rest. Then, for the first time, I dwelt upright in dark quiescence and settled external objects in the kingdom of my mind. However, I had been cultivating false thoughts for such a long time that my feelings led me to continue to see characteristics. I came to the point where I wanted to probe the difficulties inherent in these illusions. In the end, I clearly apprehended the Buddha nature within myself and engaged in the practice of thusness. For the first time, I realized that within the square inch of my own mind, there is nothing that is not my true self. The bright pearl comprehends clearly and darkly penetrates the deep tendency of things." And then he has a little poem he's written. "Through cross-legged sitting, dhyana, in the end, you will see your original nature. Inevitably, you will fuse with things and purify mind. If, For a split second, thought arises, you will be in the conditioned realm of coming and going, in the midst of birth and death. To think thoughts is like engaging in an immoral act. You may search for Dharma and surmise various things, but your karma will not be changed by thinking. Given revolving and increasing defilement, minds find it difficult to reach the ultimate. The wise one, upon hearing about the mind, awakens to the source. He realizes that ascetic activities are in vain. All over the world, everywhere, are people deceived by the evil one, who clamor in vain and engage in meaningless arguments, making false explanations. They teach sentient beings falsely, talking about remedies. They cure not one disease. Things have always been in a state of perfection, and there has never existed a deluded subject. How could there be good and evil, false and correct? One should know that obtaining the truth is having nothing to obtain, and losing is having nothing to lose.